is Miles from the UK. Thank you, Miles.
Oh, are we starting?
Yeah.
Oh, crikey. Crikey, I thought it was a bit of an intro or, you know, the preamble or something. Well, caught me off guard. Thank you, Tom. My name's Miles, and I'm still, well, let's just say I'm sober in secular AA. I like to say that. I'm sober in secular AA, and it's the truth. And I am very, very fond of secular AA. Bit of a long story, and see if I can, you know, not say anything that, you know, is too boring or whatever. But we were just talking about Iceland before, and that's where I got sober. I got sober in Reykjavik, Iceland in 1989. I'd been living there. I was 36 years old or 35. I'd been living there a long, long time. And my alcoholism, you know, it was kind of tempered because I had a job. I worked in a design studio as a graphic artist, as an illustrator. I used to swim every day with my boss, drink on the weekends with my boss, and go to macrobiotic restaurants. Now, that doesn't sound like the sort of, you know, hard story you'd read in the back of the big book, does it really? However, within that, you know, my mental and emotional state was, you know, really, really poor. And I was quite isolated, and I drank. And Iceland is a wonderful place to be anonymous and fit in with the others. There's always a worse drunk around. You know, you've only got to go into Reykjavik on a Saturday night, and it's the Vikings gone berserk. The wonderful thing about getting sober in Iceland is that it's a very, very small community, and they still have this kind of old fashioned, which I love. Old-fashioned, a bit like they said in the doctor's opinion, you can rely absolutely on what these men say about themselves. If you've been sober a couple of years, then, you know, people wanted you to work for them. Family illness, most people had an alcoholic in the family. There was strong Al-Anon and whatever. Going back to the very beginning, I won't go through a drunkologue, but just little bits of my story that added up as to why I chose alcohol and drugs to ease myself out of my emotional discomfort and my dis-ease with myself, which was quite strong. Mother and father, mother had a tragedy just before I was born. She had her firstborn daughter, Kathleen, who would have been my sister, died of leukemia at the age of 2.5. And my mother and father knew from about the age of 1 that this was going to happen. And you know, whenever I talk about it, I just feel something in my heart there about how awful that must have been for them back in those days when there was no grief counseling, you know. And I was born pretty soon afterwards. So whatever happened, you know, I grew up with a heartbroken mother who'd been, you know, had a nervous breakdown, and that's where my early years were. The rest of my family life was, you know what, I was treated well. You know, there was no alcoholism in my family. There was my mother's mental health, but you know what, it doesn't have to be like that. It doesn't take a lot. I grew up being very shy, very reserved. It was a family that had this very sort of strict conservative values. Boys are seen but not heard. Anger is a dirty word. Whenever adults come around, go off to your room. So I didn't learn to socialize or learn how to be free with my parents, but I did have a really active life on my own, and that involved fishing and, you know, doing boys stuff. And when I look back on my childhood, I was quite blessed. And I use that word in secular, not in any religious sense, but that word to me is the best word I can come up with, you know. But things started going AWOL in my teens. I started smoking marijuana, started drinking at the age of 14, 15, fell in love with a girl from my school, absolutely smitten. And I was like a little boy, really. And she dumped me. And when she dumped me, my sense of abandonment and my sense of loss from finally having a kind of close connection with somebody absolutely destroyed me. I had a suicide attempt at the age of 17. We were supposed to go to art school together. I I went to, I put myself into a psychiatric hospital for a while and realized it was like one flew out of the cuckoo's nest and I needed to get out. I wasn't as bad, but I was really, really mixed up. I can look back now and think and recognize that it wasn't so much the drugs or the alcohol, but it was the family dynamics. And, you know, I've done a lot of work on that, and Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me open up the door to be able to, you know, go and find therapists and pursue other means to dig a little deeper, you know, after doing all the step work and everything else we get to do. So, I went to art school and kept very quiet, did well at art school, tentatively have a girlfriend. I drank a bit. It was quite controlled. But then I went to Iceland and my drinking really took off. Even though I said I had a job and everything like that, I was pretty desperate. And I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a girlfriend who was a drinker, and I didn't understand it. And I went to see a therapist in Iceland about my girlfriend, you know, the blame game. And after a couple of sessions, he gave me a book, Children of Alcoholics, Adult Children. I kind of read it and thought, well, what's this? Then he gave me the 12 questions that they often give, you know, to decide whether you're an alcoholic. And there's a line in the big book that says, once in a while, you may tell the truth. And that day, I told the truth. And I answered about 9 out of the 12. And from then onwards, things changed. That was like, I don't think I'm an alcoholic, but I better do it. I'm desperate. I'm feeling suicidal. I'm about to lose my job. I am, you know, I'm in a spiritual malaise. I'm in bad shape. So I went into Alcoholics Anonymous in Iceland. It was a candlelit meeting, and they got a seat in the middle. And there was a chap there who I'd always really liked. He was the cool guy at parties, and he always had the best hash and a bit of cocaine, and you know, and there he was, and he was sober, and I didn't know what was going on, but he said, there's a chair waiting for you here. I hated that. How dare you? How dare you? And I realized, looking back, that I was that desperate but picky, you know, and I did not understand alcoholism. I can look back now and say it was a mixture of ignorance, but it was also that side of the illness. And I'm reluctant to use disease these days. I'm not going to go into it, but it's certainly a maladaptive coping mechanism. But I realized about denial, you know, after time, that denial was what had been keeping me drinking. I'm not that bad. Look at me, health food restaurant, you know, working, swimming. No, you know what? Alcohol. I was brewing, and I was saying the government rose the prices of booze, which was really, really expensive. So I stopped eating as much and spent that money on alcohol. I started brewing beer in the spare room, not just one barrel, but 300 bottles at a time. I had a little grow light area where I'd got these seeds from Amsterdam that someone had gave me. So I was growing my little harvest. And, you know, during the period of my first year of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I started talking about this, it became clearer that, you know, this wasn't the way ordinary people live. So, I must say, I came into AA in Iceland and I haven't had a drink since. I was really, really, really low. I kept coming to meetings, got a sponsor, and met up with him, had a couple of books. What did I read? Read Living Sober, as Bill sees it, and the 24-Hour Day book. Now, that's very, very gaudy, but you know what? And I must say, at the time, it didn't worry me. You know, I was willing to go to any length. So, it was only after a few years that I started putting that back and started looking, I need to move forward with other things. So, it was a wonderful community for getting sober in. You know, we did a lot of stuff outside of the meetings, and it was like flotsam and jetsam from all over the world who'd arrived in Iceland and, you know, as alcoholics or become alcoholics. And we all met in this English-speaking meeting called the Midnight Sun Group. And a lot of Icelanders came along. They really liked it because the Icelandic meetings were a bit dour, you know. They can be very stiff. And I didn't understand the language. I'd been there for years and years and years. One of the first things my sponsor requested I do. Miles, you're going to go to Icelandic lessons. And did I mention that that guy who I thought was really cool, who'd done the cocaine and stuff, he was my sponsor, David. So, you know, I started working the steps and, you know, knew nothing. This is year 1989, 34 years ago. So that's what I had. I've got to keep an eye on the clock here, right? I moved to America nearly 2 years sober. I knew that it was time to move away from Iceland. You know, I'd been there many years and I was hiding out. And I decided to go to America, and I did. And I moved to a little place near Katona. Some of you, I don't know who you've got in this group from America, but in New York State, Westchester County, Putnam County. And when I joined that group there, it was a massive move. But I was a year and a half, 2 years sober, and it felt so, I was so excited. You know, I'd started reading those three books from AA literature, but because I couldn't read when I first came in, I couldn't concentrate. But little by little, I put on a bedside table, pass it on, Dr. Bob and the Old Timers, and the Bill Wilson one, I forget what it was called. So I was really interested in, what is this AA stuff? Who were these guys? What was going on? And I for me, learning to read made it even more special to me in early recovery. And by and large, it turned out that Bill Wilson's house was 15 miles down the road from me. And the chap, and I joined a group called Soma's Serendipity, and I got straight into the group and I asked the guy to be my sponsor. And it was a laconic Texan from Paul Lang. Really lovely guy, Paul. He'd been a Vietnam vet. He loved Harleys, which I didn't. I eventually got a Triumph, and we used to ride around together. We went up to the Wilton house up in Vermont, and we went, you know, we used to go to men's halfway houses and do incoming meetings and wonderful fellowship. And I miss that kind of connection I had, not only with my sponsor, but a few of his sponsees. We all hung out together, and it wasn't like, oh, there's a sponsor. It was no sort of hierarchy. It was just really nice, warm fellowship and acceptance. And it's what I needed. And it's what I still need, you know. So anyway, it worked out that Paul was he did service work at Stepping Stones. He was the archivist there. As I hadn't got any work, I was struggling to be an illustrator. AA was wonderful in, you know, meeting people. I was doing a bit of painting and decorating, this and that, struggling to get a portfolio together. And Paul said, you know, you could come and work. We need a groundskeeper at Stepping Stones. And it's not always work with sponsors and sponsors, but we can check it out. I think you're well enough, Miles, to, you know, we're able to talk to each other, which was great, really. And he got his sponsor was working there. I was scared stiff of him. Vaughan, real tough old, take the cotton wool out of your ears and put it in your mouth, or whatever the saying is, you know. I was like, whoa, he's not an easy, arty sort of, you know, touchy-feely sort of guy like I like hanging around with. But again, a relationship with Vaughan grew. He gave me this big old Buick. His car, this big old Buick that had got, it used to have a pale velour sort of top, but it had got so much moss on it. It had got a green moss top, and the car was olive green, and it was so old it was matte, but it was wonderful. I could go down to New York in it, and taxi drivers would get out of my way, you know. But so that really nice sort of people helping people. And I worked at Stepping Stones, just helping around the garden and, you know, doing odd jobs and painting and learning to do little tours when people came. And it was very special. I mean, I'm a person in secular AA who doesn't, you know, throw the big book out, throw our history out. The reason I'm in secular is for many reasons. You know, it seems to be, you know, I like the free thinkers and you know, the kind of rigidness of some AA and the God stuff. But back then, you know, where I was, it seemed like, you know, we were in a bunch of guys who were pretty easygoing and pretty accepting. What can I say? So sobriety there, I eventually did start becoming an illustrator, and I did pretty well for about 6 or 7 years, and then business collapsed. At that time, I was I was sponsoring people and still working with Paul and you know, a bunch of us going out doing surface jobs. And I always really liked that, because for me, when somebody first asked me to do service, I thought I got nothing to give. And doing whatever, somebody was talking about doing the coffee here, and we made a joke about, you know, starting off with the coffee and then moving up to, you know, maybe doing a meeting or being a secretary or going to one of the, you know, GSR meetings or whatever. But and sponsoring people and learning, you know, learning that I can't get anyone sober, and going through all of those that sort of teething stuff of, you know, I'm not in charge, I can't do this. But really wanting to get people sober and getting too much into the control, and you know, all those parts of my personality that, you know, that were being they were being unearthed, and they were being exposed in the healthy side of, you know, the things. And the very first time I'd hear women talk about being incested or you know, having sexual abuse, and I'd never heard of anything like that. And I became friendly with people, and you know, the world just sort of opened up in many ways. I lost my job for some reason. Illustration just, you know, took a tumble. It was nothing to do with anything wrong I did. So I had a sort of crisis at about 45. Didn't know what to do, and I knew I couldn't be an art teacher. I was pretty worried. I went down to a local rehab, thought I might get a job as a van driver, and I spoke to the guy in charge there. He was a young guy. He'd only got about 7 or 8, well, I say only, but for a guy in charge of a rehab, he got about 7 or 8 years. And I was telling him about, you know, my AA and stepping stones. And he said, "You know what, Miles, you could be a counsellor here." I'm like, "What? What?" So they took on unqualified counsellors in the evening shift. And it was a place called, I don't know if there's anyone from New York, a place called Arms Acres. And it's quite a big 12-step rehab. They got a detox with a doctor on board and qualified nurses, a women's wing, three men's wing, and an adolescent wing. So it was a big place. So I started working there, and that was an experience. And you know, I mean, since then I've kind of that's what I've been doing on and off up until retiring, retiring by force a few years ago. And that was a wonderful experience, but it was also taught me that I have to look after my own recovery. And at the same time, I realized that in order to get a slightly less strenuous or taxing, or it's not like sponsoring someone. A lot of these guys, some of you know, they're not in rehab for the main reason, and all sorts of skullduggery going on. You wouldn't believe the things. Well, you would believe. And so quite a lot of it was policing. Quite a lot of it was, you know, helping nurses out when people were having seizures. And so I got to see all realms of chemical dependency, and it was hard work. And you know, a lot of this I would take in. So I realized I had to go to school. So I started a school thing in order to get a job as a case manager, which would be slightly, you know, give me a boundary and give me, you know, slightly better money, and it would just be better for my well-being. So at that point, it was a really difficult time in my life, because I was working in a rehab. I was going to school to study something. And I'll tell you the truth, I still wished I was an illustrator, and I was trying to go to AA meetings, and I was getting full up to here with it. And you know, so that's a pretty difficult place to be in, you know. So I didn't lose contact with people, but yeah, I had a couple of breakdowns in recovery, you know, various levels, but I haven't picked up a drink. Remarkably, that desire left me, but suicidal thoughts, definitely. Definitely. So that's, you know, I'm a work in progress, and been ups and downs, and you know, it'll be 34 years in September if I get that far. And it's a life led, you know. I've led a full life, and if things never get better for me, I can look back and say, yeah, you know what, I've met some wonderful people, and I'm only here because of other people. you know what, my higher power, I said it many years ago, my higher power wears flesh and bones and skin and has massive heart. And there have been, you know, just wonderful people I've met along the road. I came back to England probably about 10 years ago. It was a really big move. My mum, God bless her, poor old mum, was getting really, really old and kept going into hospital. And I just couldn't afford to keep coming back. So I made the move back, and it was a really big one. I you know, I didn't own a house or own anything, really. I've been working paycheck to paycheck. You know, in America, I had some wonderful hobbies. I got myself an old Jeep Wrangler, an old, really old one with a convertible top, and I sit on top, kayak I put on top, and I drive through the night in the summer down to where is it? What's the name of that place? I can't remember. Anyway, go past Connect, Rhode Island. Yeah, I'd go to Rhode Island, and I'd fly fish for saltwater for bass, and I went fly fishing in the Catskills, which I loved, and oh, I wish I could do it again. You know, lots and lots of taking trips up to Maine, and every winter I took my motorbike up to Maine and stayed in a little cabin and fished for the landlocked salmon. Hardly caught anything, but I had a lot of adventures, and so you know. That was the benefits of sobriety. All through this, I've been trying to find a nice lady to compliment me. And, well, that's another story. I found lots of nice ones, but there's a part of me that still is that little boy that I talked about earlier that, you know, attracts people and then perhaps attracts emotionally unavailable or gets very scared and runs away myself. And so I've never really been in a very long-term relationship. I stayed in England and looked after mum for a long time. Did some hard jobs here, working in the prison as an alcohol counsellor, working in a men's shelter. Difficult. And watching mum gradually lose her. She had a stroke and then she ended up in hospital and finally had to put her in an old people's home. And I lost my sister about 16 years ago to suicide. So there was no family around. The mum's neighbours were wonderful, but it was quite a lot I had to hold on myself. And when she finally passed, I just decided I had a little inheritance and decided I've just got to look after myself for a while. So I the therapist I was seeing then, therapy has been a wonderful thing for me. I've had a lot of it. You know, if more is better, it hasn't, you know, I still need a lot more. They put me in touch with a really interesting counselling course nearby. It's a place called Dartington, which was an old, almost sort of bohemian kind of, what would you call it? An enclave or something from the 30s or the 40s. But anyway, they had a really good quality counselling course, integrative. So it was things like Gestalt, person-centered, trying to think what the others were. It was CBT and I can't remember. My brain's gone. Anyway, so I studied that for a while, and those 2 years of that, which was really, really good for me. And I didn't expect to get a job, but I had enough money to do it, and I could relax with a little bit of money from my inheritance, which soon ran out. But I'm looking at the time here. I've got a couple more minutes. Anyway, this wasn't supposed to be a chronological story, but it has turned out like that. In that period, I met online my future wife. She got in touch with me on a dating site, and immediately, she was in Canada. Immediately, I said, typical story of my life. You've got in touch with me. You sound wonderful. You look wonderful, but you're unavailable. You're in Canada. Bye. Anyway, we just decided to keep in touch, and we kept in touch. And then I decided, why don't you come over? So she did. She came over to see me, and we had a really nice week together. And she went away, and then we met at Christmas, but no thought of anything going on. And then I went over to Canada to go on a experiential workshop with which was a bunch of guys called Clear Mind out of Vancouver, who were really, really, I mean, this is the stuff where Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the chance to go and join in with, you know, other forms of healing and try to that caused the alcoholism. You know, the bottles were the symptom for me. Anyway, I went out there and it really was lovely. And I met Carla again and came home and asked if she would like to get married. And I went over to Canada and got married outside in the snow. In the Edmonton in about 30 degrees, minus 30 degrees, Christmas 2015, I think it was. And so I had to come back and, you know, and plan going over. And at that point, I was getting really weary with English AA, you know, the local AA. I was just feeling lost in it. It was just, I just didn't feel like it. You know, I didn't stop going, but it didn't feel like a support for me. Anyway, I did go to Canada, and to cut a long story short, it didn't work out. I wanted it to work out, but I ended up finally getting a job in rehab, which was a really hard one. I got 12 clients, and, you know, you guys in America are aware of the fentanyl problem. It was pretty new to me, and these guys were, a lot of them were doing methamphetamine and fentanyl and lots of alcohol, of course. But so and the backup there was not very supportive. I need the support, you know. You know what, we need to be, have stuff coming in to be able to put it, or you can't give out what you don't have. So so I was getting more and more drained and it affected the relationship, and she decided wasn't going to do anything about it. So I came back in 2019, straight for COVID, and absolutely heartbroken. I thought this was a woman I was going to spend the rest of my life with, and I spent the last few years really, really trying hard to recognize the grief and work with it and arrive in England with, you know, sort of, I'm not going into any of that stuff now. I'm working as a gardener and on a very, very small pension. And I live in a really small place, and it's not what I expected. So, but I found secular AA, and that is wonderful. You know what? This is so good. I just feel where I feel comfortable. I feel accepted. I feel heard. And I live on my own out here, and I don't have family, and I don't really have friends around. So for me, secular on Zoom is really, really important. There's a couple of people here who know our group. Oh, no, I see Ian there. Good to see you. Saturday morning, Raynham. I've been fortunate enough to overstay my welcome as the chair of that group. We've had business meetings, and I've said, listen, I've been doing this for a year. I like doing it, but you know what? This is not the Miles show. Anybody want to do it? And I look round and great, no hands have gone up. So I can keep doing it. And I'm with a lovely guy called Roger. And, you know, there's people here. I can only see a few faces, but I can see Jonathan. I can see Ian. I know Roy's here. And I love these guys. And, you know, I've not met them. One of these days, I hope I will. So my message is keep on keeping on. And, you know, they used to say to me in early days, don't give up even if your ass is dropping off. This morning we did a subject of self-esteem, and there were some wonderful shares there. And I began to realize just that recovery for me continues to be, how can I just tiptoe into a little bit more self-esteem, you know, like myself enough. You know, I don't love myself, but I'm beginning to fancy myself a little bit now and again, you know, and come back into it. But So I won't say much more. I hope that's been helpful to someone. It did turn into a little bit of a monologue about, you know, then and now. So but anyway, thank goodness for secular. Thank you, Tom, for inviting me. It's really, really helped me this weekend to be able to come here and talk. Being heard is really important, and I hope to be able to hear anyone else should they need, you know, some ears to listen to. So thanks, everyone.